Beirut in shock, Beirut in the rubble. Some see this as a moment to rebuild better.
I would hope that the relief effort looks at long-term needs and not just, you know, the direct emergency response.
Also, an experimental drug is providing hope for really sick patients with COVID-19, but most of the severely ill outside the U.S. can't get the treatment.
I think that ultimately the problem is an ethical problem. It's not a scientific problem. We need to have a different way of approaching global health.
I'm Marco Werman. A writer in Zimbabwe on Monday tells her husband she's been recognized for a major book award.
And then Friday, I was texting him frantically saying I'd been arrested.
Zimbabwe's ruthless crackdown on dissent. All that and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Good to have you with us this Friday. Beirut is still combing through the rubble after Tuesday's deadly port explosion. Lebanese officials have put the death toll above 150, a number that's expected to rise as rescue workers search for the missing. Some 5,000 people were injured. Hundreds of thousands of people have lost their homes and now need housing. Another major concern in Beirut right now is getting enough food into the city. Emergency relief operations are in full swing. Joining us from Beirut is Sama Hadid from the Norwegian Refugee Council. She was in her apartment near the port on Tuesday when the warehouse full of ammonium nitrate exploded. Sama, how are you holding up, and did you suffer any injuries?
I'm very lucky to be alive and to not have suffered any injuries. When the blast hit my apartment, it just ripped through the entire place in the building, and I immediately evacuated with my neighbors who were severely injured. It was quite a distressing scene. All these injured people in the streets not being able to go to the nearby hospitals because they were completely overcrowded. Houses and homes, neighborhoods just destroyed and reduced to rubble.
One area that's going to be seriously impacted is food. We saw the Prime Minister of Lebanon talking about food shortages in May. So what does the destruction at the port now mean for Lebanese who've been out of work for months and barely able to feed their families?
At the moment, there are hundreds of thousands of people who are homeless. Finding shelter, I think, is an immediate need that needs to be addressed. But also cash assistance needs to be provided to Lebanese families and communities who are affected by the blast. The Norwegian Refugee Council is rolling out shelter assistance, but also cash for rent assistance. But in the long term, I think a lot of aid needs to be directed to supporting livelihoods as well.
So I saw a picture yesterday of those destroyed grain silos at the port, and I saw what looks like tons and tons of now useless grain just piled in the water. Are you seeing the impact of the food supply yet? Are food prices going up? Are store shelves empty?
Well, it's hard to assess the impact of the food security situation right after the explosion. But even before the explosion, food prices were rising because of the economic crisis that is facing the country. And there were food shortages. Communities were struggling to put food on their table. So this blast hitting the area which receives large imports of wheat is only going to exacerbate hunger in the country.
I mean, if the first urgent need is shelter, food has to come in a close second. So once shelter is determined for the hundreds of thousands of people who no longer have a roof over their heads, how will they be fed?
Well, I think there's a number of emergency responses in place to help families rebuild their lives. But I think in the long term, there needs to be funding to help Lebanese communities deal with the economic crisis that they've been facing for many, many months now. So the emergency relief effort has to look at the long term as well.
We reported yesterday on French President Emmanuel Macron's visit to Beirut with promises of support. The president of Australia promised more than $1 million in aid. The U.S. is sending in plane loads of food. So is Iran. How confident are you that Lebanon's most vulnerable people are going to get through this?
Well, what we know is that funding is being directed to organizations on the ground. reaching people in need. I myself have been seeing the amazing volunteer effort, but other local partners and organizations distributing assistance. So I think funding to organizations on the ground is an effective way to ensure that it reaches those in need.
So Sama, you're working with a relief organization, but you're also Lebanese and live there. How have these problems affected you personally just over time?
I'm very lucky. I'm Lebanese Australian, so I have the benefit and the privilege, you know, that other Lebanese communities and families don't have here. And I think the country really is suffering. It's on its knees, and people desperately need support, both in the short term and the long term, to deal with these deeply entrenched economic issues. And the international community cannot leave Lebanon alone in this time of need and this catastrophe.
Sama Hadid leads advocacy efforts for the Norwegian Refugee Council. She's been speaking with us from Beirut. Sama, thank you very much and the best of luck to you.
Thank you.
When COVID-19 suddenly appeared earlier this year, obviously there were no proven treatments. It was a new disease. This spring, doctors gained what they hope will be an important tool treating the sickest patients. But as the world's Ilana Gordon reports, even as manufacturing ramps up, getting the drug to people who need it around the globe is already proving to be a huge challenge.
Remdesivir is an antiviral medicine. Scientists developed it at Gilead, a company in California. It was studied for Ebola, hepatitis C, and other coronaviruses. But it didn't work as well as scientists hoped, so it never made it to market. But now with this deadly new coronavirus, it's back and being put to its biggest test yet.
A trial that the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, which is the institute I direct, sponsored.
In late April, Dr. Anthony Fauci, sitting on a White House couch, spoke of this powerful new remdesivir trial.
It was an international trial involving multiple sites, not only in the United States, but in various countries throughout the world, including Germany, Denmark, Spain, Greece, the UK, etc.
Fauci and the FDA said the preliminary results were convincing enough to fast-track the drug and get it to people.
Because what it is proven is that a drug can block this virus.
For really sick patients with COVID-19, the injections of the drug could noticeably cut their hospital stays from an average of 15 days to 11. So doctors around the globe finally had something, something imperfect, but still something, that could possibly help their patients, at least in theory.
The U.S. government has cornered almost the entire global market of remdesivir.
The United States has struck a deal to buy almost the entire world supply.
The U.S. government has bought up just about all of Gilead's initial supply of the drug through the end of September. That's medicine for about 500,000 people in the United States, leaving out severely ill people with COVID-19 elsewhere. How is that possible? It's mainly because the drug is new and hasn't been scaled up yet. And because Gilead calls the shots. It controls the price of remdesivir and how it's distributed, because it's got the patent.
So a patent is a right of exclusion that governments give over inventions.
Ken Shadlin is a political scientist at the London School of Economics.
So if you have the patent over this particular molecule, then you are the only company that is allowed to produce it, import it, sell it, do anything with it.
The idea of patents is to incentivize companies to invest in drugs that may or may not ever make it to market. But Gilead has also entered agreements with 9 generic manufacturers in India, Pakistan, and Egypt, who can make and sell the drug at a discount to about 130 lower-income countries. Sudhav Chowdhury is an economist at the Center for Development Studies in Kerala, India. He says these deals have a catch. They don't include nearly half of the world, like Mexico, Brazil, and Chile, where COVID cases are surging, where health systems are struggling.
They are stuck. And that is not really discussed internationally.
These countries can't get remdesivir right now. They're not on the list for the special agreement because, for the most part, they're not low income enough. It's unclear whether they'll gain access. But this whole dynamic is not unusual. It's how a lot of new drugs are distributed around the world. Nicole Hassoun is a professor at Binghamton University in New York, examining the real-world impacts of drugs on people's health. She says remdesivir shows the global imbalance when it comes to critical new medicines.
I think that you're not going to get optimal access. For sure, you're not going to get optimal access. There are going to be lots of people who don't have access to those medications that might otherwise have had it.
But Hassoun says it doesn't have to be this way.
Ultimately, the problem is an ethical problem. It's not a scientific problem. We need to have a different way of approaching global health.
One initiative that's trying to address this is the COVID-19 Technology Access Pool. The World Health Organization set this up earlier this year with several global NGOs and the president of Costa Rica, Carlos Alvarado.
Gracias, Dr. Tedros.
Thank you, Dr. Tedros, my brother.
Alvarado said through a translator that this is about making a global commitment to guarantee that those who need life-saving drugs, wherever they live, can get it. The idea is that governments and companies would pool their data, licenses, technology, and medicines, and then participating communities could access it. So far, about 40 countries have signed on. Sudip Chowdhury, the economist in India, is skeptical.
That's a good idea, but this is unlikely to work.
He says so far, big players like the US, India, and China have not signed on. For him, remdesivir is a cautionary tale of what might come, as researchers and countries alike race to develop even more useful treatments and vaccines.
But point is, who knows? If a really effective drug is introduced, what the price will be?
And who will have access to it? For The World, I'm Alana Gordon.
President Trump followed through on his threat to ban the Chinese-owned apps WeChat and TikTok. For those of you without teenagers at home, TikTok allows you to make and share short videos online. WeChat is China's main messaging service. You can also use it to make mobile payments. Late last night, the president signed two executive orders that ban Americans from making, quote, transactions on the apps. That takes effect in 45 days. But what constitutes a transaction remains unclear. It will be up to U.S. Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross to issue more guidance in the coming days. What is clear is that TikTok users are freaking out. A lot of American teens are going on the app to post teary eulogies and goodbyes, heartfelt and ironic.
Like, I knew this might happen. You know what? No, I'm fine. Woohoo! Warm it up. Come on, let's go.
You know what? We had fun. We shared some laughs. We watched some dance. We saw some.
Are you tired of me?
Trump administration officials say they're banning TikTok and WeChat for national security reasons. The president's trade advisor, Peter Navarro, a well-known China hawk, went on CNN to share this dire warning.
Let me start and speak directly to the mothers of America here. But first of all, it's about 10 a.m. The Chinese Communist Party may know where your children are. That's essentially the problem.
Navarro says the app is collecting your kids' data and giving it to Beijing. Cybersecurity experts like Adam Siegel at the Council on Foreign Relations are skeptical.
It's not clear to me what the national security threat is of, you know, the data of 15-year-olds making funny videos.
WeChat, though, could be a different story. Yachiao Wang is a researcher with Human Rights Watch.
WeChat has served as an integral part of the Chinese government's repression. I mean, WeChat has been censoring and surveilling users outside of China.
She also says it's complicit in human rights violations. On the other hand, Wang's job would be a lot harder without WeChat.
WeChat is the platform people use to post news related to human rights, also to communicate with each other. So it's a complicated issue.
And it's not over yet. WeChat has said they want more time to review the situation. TikTok has vowed to fight the ban in court. Microsoft could also buy TikTok. Hope among its fans springs eternal.
Who knows? Maybe I'll look like an idiot and it won't get banned, but it's not looking like that.
Anyways, if TikTok is getting deleted, we're leaving in fashion. So listen, maybe follow my Insta if you want to, and if not, baby, this was fun. Love you.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres had a stark warning this week about the worldwide disruption to education because of the pandemic.
We face a generational catastrophe that would waste untold human potential, undermine decades of progress, and exacerbate entrenched inequalities.
A generational catastrophe. A disheartening prediction for sure. I spoke with Stefania Giannini, the UN's Assistant Director General for Education, about this and asked what impact she thinks school closures will have on this generation of students.
The scale of this crisis is already huge. 1 billion students and children are out of school because of the COVID-19 today. 100 countries yet to announce a date for schools to reopen. So I think that it's really a huge risk of losing an entire generation, as we could see from the very beginning of school closures, that the longer the schools remain closed, the higher the risk of increasing inequalities and learning loss.
As to those increased inequalities and learning loss you're talking about, what groups are most vulnerable from missing out on their education and why?
Well, the most vulnerable and fragile components of the education community. I can mention children with disabilities, where we could see from the beginning that moving from the traditional classroom to the virtual ones is not everywhere and always a guarantee of making the best to address their specific special needs for education. It's about girls. We can see from other crises like Ebola, for instance, that we can have increasing numbers of dropouts for girls. We can have increasing numbers of early pregnancy. And of course, it's about refugees and migrants and displaced students, where the situation of learning is already very much complicated.
Let's look at how different countries are approaching this, starting here in the U.S. We're still seeing a rising number of cases, and the first day of school is fast approaching. In fact, states like Mississippi and Georgia have already opened classrooms and faced new infections, and now students are in quarantine again. What do you recommend for the U.S.?
I think that the recommendations we find in the policy brief can work very well for the U.S. as well. This is not a national crisis. This is a global one, and there is no national solution. We can take measures that can work on the basis of some general principles. I mentioned four of them. The first is about reopening schools when safe to do so. And I think that after the green light from health authorities, schools need to put measures in place for safe return. And it's about also targeting the hardest to reach. We mentioned before the most vulnerable components of students' communities, and it's absolutely important that also in the U.S. The specific target can be considered as the first priority, reopening schools.
Mexico, interestingly, has decided to not reopen schools indefinitely. They'll be shifting a lot of the education efforts to the internet and public broadcasting, teaching on TV, basically, because nearly 95% of families in Mexico have televisions. What do you think of that decision?
I think that hybrid learning, as you define, means putting together radio channels, TV channels, and e-learning platforms where you can use, you have connectivity, something that can work. We are assisting countries like this, and we are contact with Mexico authorities as well. I can mention other countries like Senegal, for instance, where this blended learning is working and a bit assuring continuity of learning. On the other side, let me say that there are some dimensions of learning and teaching cannot be replaced easily.
So we know teachers and students are worried. Parents are really worried because they see this monumental task of teaching their kids falling to them, throwing them an extra duty that you just can't phone in. So for parents staring at this disheartening reality, what is your advice?
Parents became a bit main actors of the process suddenly. And this is another interesting component, right, that you have to take into account. And let me say that maybe in the future, there is a lot of room for rethinking the future of education, which is right now in the present, also involving better and more communities and families first, starting from parents. Of course, it's about rethinking the space of learning. It's also rethinking the time of learning, which is no more maybe confined, restricted to some hours in the morning. So I see in this sense an interesting innovation which can be important for rethinking and transforming education.
Stefania Giannini, the UN's Assistant Director General for Education, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you. Thank you very much for inviting me.
Now, a story about an anti-racism campaign in New Zealand that's taking an unconventional approach, a really unconventional approach, considering the man behind it played Hitler in last year's Oscar-winning Jojo Rabbit. Here's The World's Amanda McGowan.
Taika Waititi has lent his voice to some unusual characters. There's Korg from the superhero movie Thor Ragnarok.
Made of rocks, as you can see, but don't let that intimidate you. You don't need to be afraid unless you're made of scissors.
And there's IG-11, the bounty hunting drone from Star Wars The Mandalorian.
This is a Bacta spray. It will heal you in a matter of hours.
But in the actor and director's latest project, he's something else. The voice of racism.
Get off my property.
Gosh, your daughter has a big long name. Is there something shorter we can call her?
Oh, I didn't mean anything, but...
This is part of an anti-racism campaign launched by the New Zealand Human Rights Commission. Go onto its website and you're met with a digital disembodied head, a nose and a mouth, all distorted and pixelated. And it spews out comments like what you just heard. And this.
We're here to speak to the dean. Oh, you are the dean. Sorry.
After each comment, you can click for an explanation of why it's racist and what you can do or say to counter these things in the moment when you hear them. Waititi told the BBC that he wants the project to highlight the kinds of microaggressions and casual racism that can be routine.
You go into the site and you just basically experience what is daily racism in New Zealand for most people.
Waititi, who is of Maori descent, has long been outspoken about this issue. In a 2018 interview with magazine Dazed and Confused, he talked about people in his home country refusing to pronounce Maori names properly, for example, or his experience working at a grocery store as a kid where he wasn't allowed to man the cash register. This new campaign isn't the first time he's worked to counter racism in New Zealand.
As New Zealander of the Year, I'm calling on every one of my fellow Kiwis to help support a very important cause. Racism needs your help to survive.
Wait a minute. Keep listening.
You don't have to be a full-on racist. Just being a tiny bit racist is enough. A smile, a cheeky giggle, even a simple nod in agreement. It all adds up, and it gives others the message that it's okay.
In other words, it's not just what people say or do. It's what other people don't say or don't do. The Voice of Racism's tagline is, "Are you willing to listen?" New Zealand's government wants that to happen. The campaign also includes links to resources for those who have experienced racist incidents, and for those who have witnessed them, information on how to report them. For The World, I'm Amanda McGowan.
It's The World. Remember the rule of three. First, the 2008 Great Recession, then Trump's trade war with China.
And then, of course, the third one, now the pandemic. And those three together have transformed and, frankly, been a body blow for globalization.
Globalization 2.0 and what that could look like, still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of WGBH Boston and PRX. Belarus, just north of Ukraine in Eastern Europe. The president of Belarus has been in power for 26 years. Alexander Lukashenko is often called the last dictator of Europe. But in this Sunday's presidential election, he has a real challenger. Her name is Svetlana Tikhanovskaya. She's an opposition candidate running a successful grassroots campaign. Washington is watching the vote closely, but as The World's Daniel Offman tells us, they're not saying much.
When you compare Belarusian presidential candidates Alexander Lukashenko and Svetlana Tikhanovskaya, you quickly see that they're different in just about every way. In his State of the Nation speech earlier this week, Lukashenko says that outsiders are plotting to overthrow his government and are pointing their poisonous arrows directly at him. His tone is grim, combative, and old-fashioned. He's the quintessential strongman leader. Svetlana Tikhanovskaya, on the other hand, has a very different style.
You got used to think that men are power, but I can show that women are even more power than our men.
That's Tikhanovskaya speaking with the BBC. She's calm and composed. She's not a career politician, but she's become the face of the opposition. and she's very popular. Last week, 60,000 people showed up to one of her rallies in the Belarusian capital Minsk, making it the biggest rally in Belarus since the 90s. But even with all the support, the election result is a foregone conclusion. Alexander Lukashenko will win. The election process will not be free or fair, which puts the United States in a tricky diplomatic situation. The U.S. has had an on-again, off-again relationship with the strongman government for years. Here's Anna Gavel, managing editor of The Washington Diplomat.
In 2008, relations pretty much were severed. The U.S. imposed sanctions, also for human rights abuses. Lukashenko ousted the U.S. ambassador along with 30 diplomats, so there really wasn't much happening for many years.
That all changed this winter. That's when Lukashenko turned toward the U.S. in an effort to fend off efforts by Russia to exert more control over the country.
Here you really see the pushback from Lukashenko of not wanting Belarus to become absorbed by Russia.
Lukashenko invited U.S. diplomats to the Belarusian capital of Minsk to begin to restore diplomatic ties.
The United States wants to help Belarus build its own sovereign country.
This is Secretary of State Mike Pompeo following an announcement that the two countries would be reestablishing full diplomatic relations. For the first time in more than a decade, the U.S. would have an ambassador in Belarus, and Belarus would have one in the U.S.
We fully support Belarus' desire to make its own choices, pursue its own partnerships, and play a constructive role in the region. Your nation should not be forced to be dependent on any one partner for your prosperity or for your security.
Pompeo's talking about Russia here. For the U.S., reestablishing this relationship with Belarus was all about keeping Russia from expanding its power and influence. Here's Anna Gavel again.
I don't want to say all roads lead to Moscow, but yes, that's certainly a large component of it, I think.
Now the U.S. has to figure out how to nurture its fragile relationship with Belarus and keeping Russian power in check without condoning another rigged election of its strongman leader. Former U.S. Ambassador to Russia Michael McFaul says it's a tricky situation.
We shouldn't take sides in any elections, in my view, but we should take sides about the rules of the game. The rules of the game here have been violated. The prominent candidates before have been arrested or taken off the ballot. And yet, despite that, there has been amazing mobilization behind this opposition figure, Tsikhanouskaya.
The U.S. administration has, in fact, been talking about the so-called rules of the game. Here's State Department official George Kent speaking with Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty.
We certainly have raised the issue of having observers, as well as our desire to see the elections conducted freely and fairly. And
that's as far as most U.S. officials will go. Call out the rules of the game, but don't take sides. Here's former U.S. Ambassador to Russia, Michael McFaul, again.
I do not think it serves the purposes of free and fair elections or the Belarusian opposition, for that matter, to say that we have one side in the election. That's exactly what Mr. Lukashenko wants. He wants to portray the opposition as just being the puppets of the United States and the West.
That means standing by while Belarusian authorities have detained more than 1,000 protesters in the lead-up to the election, including journalists and political activists campaigning for Svetlana Tikhanovskaya. Lukashenko has also been trying to thwart opposition rallies by scheduling government concerts and events all around Minsk. But yesterday, in a defining moment for the opposition, two DJs sabotaged a pro-Lukashenko concert and played an opposition anthem, a 1989 song by Victor Tsoi called Changes. They're singing the chorus of the song, Change, we're waiting for change. And it's true, more people than ever are singing that tune. But for now, they're going to have to keep waiting. For The World, I'm Daniel Offman.
The president of Poland, Andrzej Duda, was sworn in for a second 5-year term this week, but it was a group of lawmakers who stole the show during the official ceremony. Members of the opposition party showed up outside parliament and formed a rainbow flag with their clothing. They held a rainbow flag as well. It was a demonstration of support for LGBTQ rights. Duda won the July election using rhetoric that opposition lawmakers say crossed a line. He talked about homosexuality as a national security threat and even said LGBTQ people are not people. upping the ante on the lawmakers' protest. Some activists could now face up to 2 years in prison for what they did. Several were arrested for hanging rainbow flags on monuments throughout the capital, Warsaw. Conservative politicians in Poland say the rainbow flag is a threat to Roman Catholic values. One of the targeted statues was Jesus holding a cross. Zimbabwe is facing a new terrorist threat, according to its president, Emmerson Mnangagwa. The threat, he says, Zimbabwe's main opposition party. Last Friday, massive demonstrations were planned to protest Mnangagwa's handling of the coronavirus outbreak and the country's collapsing economy. Anticipating those protests, authorities locked down major cities. Scores of activists and demonstrators were arrested and detained. One of them was author and filmmaker Tsitsi Dongaremba. Just days before her arrest, her latest novel, This Mournable Body, had made it onto the Booker Prize long list. Dongaremba has since been released from detention and joins us now from Harare. First of all, Tsitsi, after this experience, how are you doing? And are you currently facing charges?
I'm doing well, thank you. Having gone through that, yes, I am currently facing charges. They charged me with attending a meeting with intention to incite public violence, breach of the peace, and acts of bigotry. I was released on bail, conditional bail, and I have to report once a week, and the hearing will be in September.
Was it your understanding that violence would be taking place?
Oh, absolutely not. I had been campaigning on Facebook for people who were attending to make sure that they were peaceful and had pointed out that there was absolutely nothing to be gained from violence. I had even asked people to have positive messaging rather than potentially divisive messaging like ZANU-PF must go. I had advocated for us to envision what we wanted, a better Zimbabwe and things like that.
ZANU-PF being the ruling party. So if you would, Tsitsi, take us back to Friday. What was the protest like?
Well, the protest really suffered from the clampdown. 2 days before the demonstration, it had been declared illegal and the military had been deployed in strength. And so people were really intimidated and did not want to come out. So I just felt that since I had been engaging with the whole notion of the demonstration on social media, that I should have the courage of my convictions. And a friend said that she would demonstrate with me. So we went out. I was surprised to see no people. We had expected to find more, but there weren't any. There were other people demonstrating in very small groups in other places. But in my particular suburb, we were the only two that we saw.
So your arrest was just days after it was announced that your book, This Mournable Body, was longlisted for the Booker Prize. Loosely, it's a portrait of a young woman whose hopes for life are constantly shut down by forces beyond her control. This week must have felt really surreal.
It was, absolutely, because my husband says he can remember me screaming on the Monday when I received the news of the Booker longlisting. And then Friday, I was texting him frantically saying I'd been arrested. And so it was really two extremes in a very short space of time.
So in your book, This Mournable Body, you actually return to a character from your first novel, Nervous Conditions. The character is Tambu. And it follows Tambu, who was once young and hopeful but is now disillusioned. And all of this takes place in Harare. Would you say there's some parallel between Tambu's story and what's happening now in Zimbabwe?
Absolutely. I wrote Nervous Conditions just after independence in the 1980s, and there was this sense of hope. And I wrote it to accompany young women who were living out this hope. And then, of course, things changed. And so it wouldn't have made much sense for me to pretend that that hope still existed in the same way. And so the changes in the country's circumstances needed to be reflected in the lives of the characters. And so that's what I did in This Mournable Body.
Last Friday's protests were not the giant demonstrations that were expected because of that government crackdown. But in the days since, I understand Zimbabweans have taken to social media posting under the hashtag Zimbabwean Lives Matter. What is your take on these protests, Tsitsi? Is there a lot of momentum here?
What I like about Zimbabwean Lives Matter is that it's a positive message. It's not aggressive. It's not confrontational. And it's unifying. And so I am really happy to see that we have a hashtag now that embraces all Zimbabweans. And I think that is how we need to be going forward.
I got to say, this all feels like a rerun of the worst days of the decades-long regime of the founder of ZANU-PF, Robert Mugabe, with Emmerson Mnangagwa in the same role. Realistically, what's the future look like for Zimbabwe?
Realistically, the future for Zimbabwe looks troubled for the foreseeable future. What does give me hope is that I have a sense that Zimbabweans are willing to take some risks, not huge risks, because we know how repressive reactions from the government can be. But I do feel that Zimbabweans are becoming bolder at talking about the issues and the repression, and that's wonderful. And of course, social media is very helpful there. And so I think that if we can just continue on the trajectory that we are now, we can stave off the worst.
Author and filmmaker Tsitsi Dangaremba, it has been a pleasure to speak with you and have you on the show. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
The African continent has hit 1 million coronavirus cases. At the same time, some African airlines are starting to fly again. Kenya and Rwanda both resumed international routes this week after flights were grounded due to the pandemic. In total, Africa's aviation industry has lost around $6 billion. So how to get all those carriers back up to speed safely? The world's Halima Gikandi explains.
If you've ever traveled in East Africa, you might recognize this tune. It's the onboard airplane music for Kenya Airways. The airline is back in the air this week after the government allowed international flights to reopen. At a news conference, Kenya Airways CEO Alan Kilavuka reassured customers that it is now safe to fly.
The measures that we have taken will ensure that we completely limit the risk of transmission of this virus.
Of course, it's not just the airlines that have to worry about safety. Gilbert Kibe is the Director General of Kenya's Civil Aviation Authority. He says every part of the country's aviation ecosystem has had to adjust.
Passenger experience from leaving the transport they arrived in at the airport to entry, check-in, baggage drop-off, waiting in lounges, entering the aircraft.
Passengers from more than 120 countries are now allowed to fly in and out of Kenya. That includes the U.S., with the exception of California, Texas, and Florida. Travelers are also required to have negative coronavirus tests in hand. Of course, airport traffic in Kenya still isn't where it was before COVID-19, but Kibe is happy to see planes taking off again at the Jomo Kenyatta International Airport in Nairobi.
From where we started with zero international traffic, we're having regular services. So in terms of percentage increase in traffic movement, it's been exponential.
In fact, in recent years, the demand for flights has been on the rise in Africa. African airlines were trying to cash in and compete with foreign ones. Now, after COVID, they're just trying to stay afloat. Kenya Airways has reportedly cut salaries by as much as 80%. Rafael Kuchi works at the International Air Transport Authority. During a recent video conference, he said African airlines need emergency financial assistance in order to survive.
We want the African governments to come in and support strongly the aviation industry through cash injection, to start with.
In fact, Kenya plans to nationalize Kenya Airways. That's how things work at Uganda Airlines. It's a government-owned airline that was launched last year. Uganda itself has yet to resume international flights, but with the government's support, Uganda Airlines is doing okay. That's according to its commercial director, Roger Wamara.
Regarding staff, we have not laid off any staff. We are doing cuts on other elements of work, of course, because you're not operating. There are less charges there. There are less expenses there.
Still, Wamara says the airline could risk falling behind as other countries reopen. In the meantime, the airline has been flying special charter and repatriation flights, mostly for Ugandans stuck abroad.
So it is better than it could have been if we're not doing anything at all. keeps our equipment working, keep our pilots active, so that when it opens, we're ready to hit the ground running.
I spoke with somebody who recently took one of those repatriation flights, well-known Ugandan musician Eddie Kenzo. He was stuck in the Ivory Coast for 4 months. He got a preview of what traveling in the region during the pandemic could look like. He was screened for COVID twice and had to wear a mask.
Yeah, of course, you're a bit nervous because of the coronavirus. But no, we had to wear a mask and all that, yes.
In the end, Kenzo says it was fine. The airline did a good job. Now he's finishing a mandatory 2-week quarantine in a hotel, which he's less excited about. The musician says he's eager to travel again when Uganda's airways reopen. For The World, I'm Halima Gikandi.
Like many of you out there, here at The World, we're mostly working remotely. But our newsroom, our online newsroom, is still a constant buzz, hashing out new ideas and voices that you rely on. Find and share our latest stories on Twitter. We're at The World. You can find me there, too. I'm at Marco Werman. Okay, in less than 15 seconds, here's a definition of globalization.
I think different people mean different things by it. But what I tend to think is the flow of people, the flow of goods, the flow of services, the flow of capital across borders. The nature that the world was becoming more knitted together, if you will.
That's Zanny Minton-Beddoes, editor-in-chief of The Economist. She's given globalization a lot of deep thought, like this question her magazine recently asked, is globalization dead?
I think 2008 was really a fault line, and it marked the end of the kind of high point of modern globalization. And the financial crisis was the first big shock. I think that caused a lot of people to question certainly the free flow of global capital and the way that financial shocks could be transmitted from one country to another. But we've had two big shocks since then. The second one was the rising tensions between the US and China, and particularly the trade war of the past few years under the Trump administration. And then, of course, the third one now, the pandemic this year. And those three together have transformed and, frankly, been a body blow for globalization.
So do you think the pandemic represents the final nail in the coffin of globalization, or is it a much-needed reset, and what would that reset look like?
So I don't think it's the final nail in the coffin. I think it will take a lot to unwind the degree of global integration we've got. That said, you know, people said that the last great era of globalization at the beginning of the 20th century would carry on forever. And of course, it was radically unwound by the First World War. So I'm not being Pollyanna-ish about this, but I do think what we're seeing now is a very dramatic change in the nature of globalization, to a world where certainly for a while it's going to be much more difficult to travel, there's going to be much less travel, certainly much less migration. But I'm not sure that the deep integration we're seeing will be completely unwound. And so when we look back in a few years' time, it'll be a different kind of globalization. There'll be much greater focus on security at home. Supply chains will have shifted. And the big overriding change, and I think the one that is the most longstanding and to me actually the most worrying, is this growing tension between the world's biggest and second biggest economies. That has a potential to really reshape the world we live in.
The US and China you're talking about.
Of course, absolutely. The US and China. And, you know, people are now talking about a new Cold War. And that analogy, I think, doesn't really take you very far, because in the original Cold War, which was pretty scary at the time, between the USSR and the free world, it was between two poles, if you will, that had relatively little to do with each other economically. The Soviet Union was a relative economic minnow, and it was completely separate, or all but completely separate, from the capitalist system. Now we have China and the United States incredibly integrated with supply chains, with investment flows. And so the consequences of that worsening tension will, I think, be much, much more palpable on the world economy.
So what do proponents of globalization need to do to win back those skeptics and people who lost a lot precisely because of globalization? Like, who still supports globalization and why?
Actually, if you look at opinion polls, there are a lot of people around the world who still do support globalization. But I think there's a growing skepticism in advanced countries, and particularly amongst those people who've been hit hard, the kind of middle classes and people in manufacturing industries and so forth. And I think we need to think harder about how to assist those people and how to help with training, with education and so forth. And there are kind of two shocks that have hit at the same time. One is
the impact of globalization. But the other very related and probably bigger one is the impact of technology, whether it's, you know, the personal computer and then the internet and the rise of AI. We're living in the midst of some really big economic transformations that are having a fundamental impact on the way, the nature of work, the future of jobs. And I think the backlash that we've seen, and it's a very real backlash and a very understandable one, is because an awful lot of people have been left behind in that.
So if that gap in economic inequality and tech inequality as well, if that gap isn't closed, will globalization survive?
Well, not in the way it's seen, no. And we're already seeing that there's this big backlash against it, because it's always easiest to blame foreigners and it's always easiest to blame the other. And so even if it's not actually the cause of some of the difficulties that people have, it's a very easy political scapegoat. And that's particularly actually what worries me about this rising tension between the US and China. There are real reasons to worry about China's behavior. It's certainly, although it's much more integrated in the world economy, it doesn't play by free market rules. The current global trading system isn't really fit for purpose. But if we're not careful, we will allow this antagonism to spiral out of control in a way that will hurt everybody.
So since Donald Trump has been one of the big nationalism flag wavers, what happens to globalization if he loses or if he wins again?
Well, I think you've answered the question yourself if we have a second term of President Trump, in the sense that he is clearly a skeptic, a self-proclaimed skeptic, both of trade and of globalism, as he puts it. So I would imagine, you know, more of the same. What happens if he doesn't win and Joe Biden wins? We'll see. There's certainly more talk about multilateralism and working with allies and so forth. But the single biggest challenge that we've talked about, that of the US-China relationship, I think is going to be a very big and difficult challenge, whoever is president.
Zanny Minton-Beddoes, editor-in-chief of The Economist, with her take on the future of globalization. Zanny, thanks very much.
My pleasure. Great to talk to you.
I think of the many people that globalization has left behind. And this week, especially, thoughts turn to the people of Beirut, caught in a disaster beyond their control, an order of fertilizer going to Mozambique from the Republic of Georgia and essentially abandoned in the port of Beirut. We leave you today with a song for Beirut by Lebanon's most beloved singer, Fairouz. Li Beirut, or My Beirut. Fairouz released it in 1995 after 15 years of civil war in Lebanon, but the words are still sadly relevant. From my heart, I send peace to Beirut, Fairouz sings. She is wine from its people's spirits. From its sweat, she is bread and jasmine, she goes on. So how did its taste become the taste of fire and smoke? We come to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH in Boston. Stay strong and be safe this weekend. We'll be back with you on Monday.